You're listening to KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 7 a.m. Coming up front, stay tuned.
Good morning, it's Friday, July 19th, 2013. This is Up Front. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. On today's show, a growing surveillance operation in Oakland.
It's not clear at all for what period of time the data will be kept by the Domain Awareness Center. It's not clear who will have access to this information. It's not clear how it will be disseminated to other outside agencies as well. Those policies are still completely unclear.
Why is the Department of Homeland Security putting millions of dollars into helping Oakland build a Domain Awareness Center? We'll have investigative journalist Ollie Winston in studio. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert.
And I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We'll also speak with physician Paul Song about President Obama's signature law, the Affordable Care Act, how Republicans keep trying to stymie it, and how ordinary people can make sense of some of its beneficial provisions.
But first, Detroit files for Chapter 9 protection. We'll look at the politics behind the largest municipal bankruptcy in the history of the country. That's all next, after this news.
I'm Eileen Alfandari with news headlines. Detroit has become the largest city in the country ever to file for Chapter 9 bankruptcy. Republican Governor Rick Snyder called bankruptcy the one feasible path for the city, which has long-term debt that could be as high as $20 billion and a budget deficit of $380 million.
Today, I authorize the emergency manager for the city of Detroit to seek federal bankruptcy protection. This was a difficult and painful decision, but I believe there were no other viable options.
Kevin Orr, a bankruptcy expert hired by the state in March to stop Detroit's fiscal freefall, said Detroit would continue paying its bills and employees. He said he was unable to persuade a host of creditors, unions, and pension boards to take pennies on the dollar to help with the city's massive financial restructuring. If the bankruptcy filing is approved, city assets could be liquidated to satisfy demands for payments. Former city workers who paid into a retirement system and retired with promises of a pension and health care may find themselves out in the cold. University of California Regents voted to confirm Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano as the first woman to lead the UC system. Student Regent Cynthia Flores was the only regent to vote against Napolitano, citing the record number of deportations she presided over as head of Homeland Security. Napolitano defended her record, saying she's been an advocate for the Federal Dream Act and immigration reform.
Documented or undocumented, we welcome all students to the University of California. We are here, we're in the business of education.
Immigrants' rights groups rallied against Napolitano. UC Santa Barbara student Gloria Campos told the Regents selecting Napolitano sends the wrong message.
And it doesn't make me feel safe as an undocumented student. You can say she doesn't have the power to deport me as the UC president, but just the fact that she has that history creating these programs that have resulted in students being detained in detention centers, inhumane detention centers. These are real stories of our fellow peers in the UC system. And just really think about what that means for students that are incoming first years with family that is undocumented, with themselves who are undocumented, having someone with history and security and surveillance. This is not what our university is supposed to represent.
Supporters praise Napolitano as a leader who has managed large, complex public agencies and said her political skills would help UC secure money from the state, federal grants, and donors. At the end of the public comment period, students started chanting. Police ordered everyone to clear the room.
Undocumented!
Napolitano is set to start her job in late September and will make a base salary of $570,000, about $20,000 less than her predecessor, but much higher than her $200,000 salary as head of the Department of Homeland Security. California's official unemployment rate dropped a tenth of a percentage point to 8.5% last month. The Employment Development Department said the state added 30,000 jobs. But there's bad news for those who remain unemployed. They're likely to be ineligible to receive an additional 10 weeks of unemployment insurance funded by the federal government. Unemployed people living in states that average under 9% unemployment for 3 months lose the extra 10 weeks of aid. The Federal Department of Labor is expected to make the determination today. Trayvon Martin's parents are speaking out for the first time since a jury acquitted George Zimmerman on all charges in the shooting death of their teenage son. Sabrina Fulton told CNN's Anderson Cooper the verdict came as a complete shock to her.
And I thought for sure that the jury looked at Trayvon as an average teenager that was minding his own business, that wasn't committing any crime, that was coming home from the store and were feet away from where he was actually going. And I just believe that they realized that. But when I heard the verdict, I kind of understand the disconnect, and that maybe they didn't see Trayvon as their son. They didn't see Trayvon as a teenager. They didn't see Trayvon as just a human being.
Florida Governor Rick Scott says he will not ask lawmakers to change the state's Stand Your Ground law. Scott talked last night with some of the protesters who've been occupying his office for 3 days following the verdict in the Zimmerman murder trial.
You have an opportunity to be brave, right? To be brave in this time, because we've done what? Shared our stories with you, right? And I know you have a heart. I know you have a heart. People may paint you as otherwise, but I know you have a heart there. And I think it's important that you listen to that heart, listen to the people that are here, listen to the people that may come, should it not go the desired way tonight, and really think about what's a better way forward and what's a true way to honor, in both words and actions, the life and the death of a young man that died under your watch, not just the neighborhood watch, but your own.
Scott said he'd be willing to listen to the group's ideas on how to deal with racial profiling, but the Florida governor said he does not support a repeal of Stand Your Ground.
So thanks for coming. I'm not going to call a special session. I don't believe right now that Stand Your Ground should be changed. But I tell you right now, I appreciate you, and I look forward to seeing you again.
The Senate confirmed two high-profile nominees for President Obama's cabinet, whose selection had been held up by Republican filibusters. Tom Perez won confirmation as Labor Secretary and Gina McCarthy as Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. For the past 4 years, Perez has led the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. He has won praise for aggressive enforcement of voting rights and other laws, but drew criticism from Republicans, including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Based on the evidence, Tom Perez is more than just some left-wing ideologue. He's a left-wing ideologue who appears perfectly willing to bend the rules to achieve his ends. And does this ends justify the means approach to his work, not simply his ideological passion? It's so worrying to me about Mr. Perez.
Despite those criticisms, Perez was confirmed to head the Labor Department on a vote of 54 to 46. McCarthy was confirmed to head the EPA on a vote of 59 to 40. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, patchy morning fog and clouds, then sunny. Highs in the 70s to lower 80s around the bay, the 90s in the warmest interior valleys. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny, highs 97 to 103 degrees. You can hear expanded versions of our local news reports at pacificaeveningnews.org. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news at 7:30.
7:08 in the morning, you're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Late yesterday, Detroit became the largest municipality to file for bankruptcy in the history of the United States. This is a move that could lead to the quick liquidation of public assets in Detroit. We're talking about large expanses of public land, publicly owned utilities like the water department, zoo animals, even an art collection valued at roughly $1 billion. Now, partly this is a story about a city in economic decline. Detroit's population peaked at 1.8 million people in the middle of the last century. It's down to 700,000 people now. That leaves a lot less tax money to maintain the same amount of infrastructure. But this is also partly a political story. The person who filed for bankruptcy is not anyone who the people of Detroit have voted for. It's an emergency manager who was imposed on a heavily black and heavily Democratic city by Republican Governor Rick Snyder. And that's the person who will be calling a lot of shots about how that bankruptcy is navigated. Well, joining us to talk about the situation is Shay Howell. She's a professor in the Department of Communication and Journalism at Oakland University in Michigan. Welcome.
Thank you, Brian. I'm glad to be with you.
Tell us about this emergency manager law.
Well, I think the place to begin is to understand that the emergency manager law had been in existence for almost two decades. And that had placed an emergency manager over our school board, which was met with great resistance in the city. In fact, we have a school board that we call the school board in exile that has been trying to manage the school system. Meanwhile, with this new Republican governor, we had a change in that long-standing law that gave an emergency manager extraordinary powers, including setting aside all elected officials and abrogating all contracts with the city. That law was so onerous for the whole state that a petition drive was launched. We had over 250,000 signatures. We successfully, after much effort, got that petition on the ballot and repealed statewide this emergency manager legislation. The city of Detroit voted, which doesn't agree on almost anything, 92% of us voted to get rid of the emergency manager law. And then the right-wing Republican legislature, in a lame duck session, reinstituted the very same law, but attached it to an appropriations amount, and that meant we could not use a public referendum to repeal it. So this law has been fought for by the Republican right-wing agenda in the state and has been strongly resisted over and over again by the people in the city.
So I understand it's now estimated that since Detroit has been placed under an emergency manager, over 50% of the black population of Michigan is living in cities or municipalities where they don't have local elected officials empowered to do anything.
Yes, over 50%, I think it's 52% of African Americans have had their right to vote for elected officials stripped on the basis of a financial argument. In addition to that, 75% of African American elected officials have been removed from power.
So what's the alternative? The narrative from the government is that this is straight up financial exigency, almost $20 billion worth of debt on the city of Detroit's books. It calls for extraordinary measures.
Well, you know, first of all, there's been a great deal of dispute about the dimensions of this debt. And part of the dispute rests with the fact that Detroit, like many metropolitan areas around the country, has been underfunded from its fair share of state revenue sharing. Detroit already has the highest tax rate of any city in the state of Michigan, and frankly, one of the highest in the country. So as a city, we have taxed ourselves in order to provide for public services. But while we have been taxing ourselves, the state has been steadily withdrawing any support for municipal activities that benefit both the entire state and the region. So the debt is a disputed concept because it makes it, when it's reported in most of the mainstream media, it sounds as though Detroit has been profligate, spending all kinds of money for all sorts of wild things, which couldn't be further from the truth. We've already reduced our police force. We've already closed our parks. We've already turned off lights. We've already restructured much of our services. And in spite of that, the state continues to withdraw money that it has traditionally used to support municipal services. And further, it has reneged on a specific deal with Detroit around revenue sharing. So when the governor says, boy, we have no choice, he and his policies have helped bring us to this state.
If the bankruptcy petition is accepted by a judge, it puts a lot in play that wasn't in play before. The court can dissolve contracts. It can cut pensions. It can sell off public assets. Do you think the state has a political agenda in the bankruptcy process?
Yes, actually, I think the state has tried to avoid bankruptcy. The powers that you just enumerated have all been given to an emergency manager.
And so you're already there.
So we're already there. We have no public control over that. What is different, and one of the reasons why I think bankruptcy is probably a good idea, is that it removes the power from the Republican state legislature and places it in the hands of a bankruptcy court, which has far more experience than either our state legislature or anybody else has in this process. So it's quite likely that we will be treated much more fairly in the federal courts than by our own state legislature.
Tell us a little bit about what's at stake. What are you worried could happen in a bankruptcy proceeding?
Well, I think the biggest worry for everyone is that that the pension and health and retirement benefits of people would be restricted. Kevin Orr, our current manager, had offered 10 cents on the dollar for pension funds. And aside from the breaking of a covenant among generations, many of these pensioners are current Detroit residents. And should they lose that income, that would create a further downward spiral in our neighborhoods because they wouldn't be able to provide for needed health services. They wouldn't be able to provide for their homes. So protecting the pension funds and the health benefits for our retirees seems to me critical. And generally speaking, bankruptcy proceedings have been cognizant of trying to balance the pension reductions, if they have to do that, with an equal balance on the creditor side. But the Wall Street Journal reported just a week ago that while Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, was asking the pensioners to take 10 cents on a dollar, Bank of America wanted 75 cents on a dollar. So hopefully the courts would be a bit more even-handed and a bit more thoughtful about the effects of this kind of thing.
Well, it looks like it will be up to a judge to sort that out. That's all the time we have. Shay Howell, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Brian, and thanks for keeping us in mind with everyone.
Shay Howell is a professor in the Department of Communication and Journalism at Oakland University, which is in Michigan. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Taker. We're going to take a look at the expansion of a very beefed up surveillance program in Oakland in a minute. Stay with us. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. The city of Oakland is building out a surveillance operation that may serve as a model for many other cities in the country. At the end of this month, the city council will vote to allocate an additional $2 million for something called the Domain Awareness Center, a facility that is already harvesting information from street cameras and license plate readers. But could students start collecting footage from the surveillance cameras of other agencies, like the school district? One problem critics are raising, the city doesn't yet have any policies on how it'll use that footage, how long it'll keep it, or what steps it will take to protect privacy. Joining us to talk about it, we have Ollie Winston, a freelance reporter who's been covering police and civil liberties for the East Bay Express, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and many other outlets. Welcome.
Thanks for being here.
Tell us about the Domain Awareness Center. How did it start?
The Domain Awareness Center is one of a number of port security projects, maritime security projects that are funded through the Department of Homeland Security. It began in 2009 when the Port of Oakland received funding through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the Stimulus Act, to explore the building out of a surveillance center that would help ensure the port security and give them the ability to respond quickly if there was a situation such as a terrorist attack, an earthquake, a tsunami, or such other, you know, extreme situations. And over time, this project evolved from a port security project to basically a surveillance center that covers the entirety of the city of Oakland. The port and the city of Oakland entered into an MOU a couple of years ago.
A
memorandum of understanding. They entered into an agreement a couple of years ago to undertake this project together and they've spent about $3.38 million in federal grant funding, all from the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Emergency Management Administration. They approved all this money to explore and design the building of a domain awareness center, which would link cameras on city property, on port property, gunshot detection sensors, the alarm feeds that are available on the port, and let's see, the city's crime view software, which allows the police department to see what sort of trends are developing for crime. That would it would also integrate their computer-assisted dispatch into this unified center, the Domain Awareness Center, which is physically located at a firehouse, at Firehouse 1 on Martin Luther King Jr. Way in downtown Oakland.
So once all that information is collected, is it under Oakland's control?
This project is, even though it's federally funded, it's run ostensibly by the fire department, actually. The official in charge of it is the director of the Office of Emergency Services in Oakland, which is under the fire department. So there's a strange interplay here where you have the fire department, the police department, the port, and the city's information technology department all involved in crafting this project.
So what can they do with the Domain Awareness Center that they couldn't do before?
The Domain Awareness Center, when it's built out, will allow, currently as it looks right now, there are about 135 cameras from the port and I believe about 4 from the city of Oakland that are currently integrated into the system software. It basically provides a view of the city of Oakland and the port of Oakland, and it has little points on it where you can click on that point. You either get access to a live camera feed, you get access to historical information about a sensor, whether that be a motion detection sensor on the port, a gunshot detector in East Oakland, or some other sort of feed, a license plate reader as well. License plate readers are also an important part of this project. So it gives access to individuals at the Domain Awareness Center in downtown Oakland, and as well remote people who access the system remotely at the port, or even, you know, police who can access this through their own laptops or their own, you know, iPads. So this sort of system, it links together a tremendous amount of information from throughout the city. And also, it's worth mentioning that about 75 of those cameras on the port property already have video analytic capability, which is what sort of software that's called a smart video software. They have the capability to detect and identify motion as well as images. They're able to identify what something is, whether it's a car, whether there's, you know, a container that's open. The software that's installed on these cameras is very sophisticated. And it's worth noting that it's not that much of a jump away from facial recognition software, which is still very controversial and has not been installed in the system, but the officials who run the system say that it's perfectly capable of being overlaid onto the existing array. However, it's not clear at all for what period of time the data will be kept by the Domain Awareness Center. It's not clear who will have access to this information. It's not clear how it will be disseminated to other outside agencies as well. Those policies are still completely unclear.
So this develops report protection, but what the city's been wrestling with in recent years is its inability to manage demonstrations.
And crime.
So is the city talking about how it's going to be used for those purposes?
Yes and no. I mean, the official line on the Domain Awareness Center that keeps getting repeated at council hearings by the people who are working on this project is that it is a... it's a situational awareness system. It's a situational awareness system that allows law enforcement and first responders to get as complete a picture of whatever scenario is happening as possible. So the scenario that they laid out at the Public Safety Committee hearing on July 9th was, you know, the wreck that happened over on 880 a couple of years ago when a tanker went up in flames. And they said, you know, the fire department battalion chief got up there and said, this would have given us an ability to respond to this much quicker. We could have seen the situation from all sides, and it could have really helped our response time, and it could save lives. And it's hard to argue with that proposition. At the same time, though, the amount of information that is being collected by this system and the continual access that law enforcement will have to it, the staffing levels, by the way, they're applying next year, or currently they're applying for another grant of $2.6 million that would fund a police sergeant, a police department analyst, and an individual from the port who would all staff the Domain Awareness Center on a 24/7 basis.
So you could imagine it being really useful during a natural disaster. You could also imagine some police captain trying to figure out who the leader of a protest is and then piece together every place that person's driven or shown up on a camera in the past 6 months.
It's not far-fetched, especially given the city's recent appeal for, you know, citizens to call in and identify individuals who have been captured in photographs that were taken during the recent disturbances last week.
So here's the issue. I mean, Oakland is wrestling with having perhaps the worst track record in the country when it comes to its police department's handling of civil liberties and its complete inability to come into compliance
with the terms of a 10-year-old settlement agreement over the conduct of its police department. It sounds like a very dangerous tool to put at their disposal until those issues are resolved.
That's one criticism that's been raised quite frequently. It was certainly out there at the council meeting last Tuesday. The city council actually had this on their consent calendar. It was not even scheduled for a public forum. It was supposed to be some. It was supposed to be, you know, a very quick approval of the $2 million that were being earmarked for the next stage of this process, which is to fund the build-out of the system beyond city and port cameras to incorporate cameras and sensors and license plate readers from the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, from Caltrans, from BART, from the Oakland Unified School District, from the Joint Powers Authority of the Coliseum. There's also talks that have been had between the city and the Northern California Regional Intelligence Center, which is the local Department of Homeland Security fusion center that disseminates intelligence throughout the 14 counties that stretch from Monterey up to up to the Oregon border. So there's also another local regional intelligence fusion center that's asking for access to the system as well.
Incidentally, how is the city's police department doing now that it has court-appointed oversight?
Actually, the progress on the reforms has picked up since Thomas Frazier, the former Baltimore police commissioner, was appointed as the compliance director. The pace of the reforms has picked up, but at the same time, there's a new round of conflict, which I'll be writing about for next week's Eagle Bay Express, between the city administrator, Deanna Santana, and the compliance director in series of exchanges in court documents basically over the last, since the end of June. Santana was accused by Frazier and the court monitor and the attorneys who represent the plaintiffs in the original Ryder's suit, John Burris and Jim Channon. Santana was accused of interfering with the compliance director's work, and on June 27th, Judge Delton Henderson, who's overseeing the case, issued an order demanding that the city administrator not interfere with the compliance director's authority. Otherwise, he is threatening sanctions and contempt of court rulings.
But what incentive would she have for interfering with the court-appointed monitor?
It's really not clear. It's been intimated that the city administrator is struggling with the loss of control of certain aspects of the police, of running the police department, to the compliance director. But I honestly, it's very difficult to say. All I know is that it's come up in court documents. It's been a very public debate. And she's also been accused on another topic. She's also been criticized for delaying the transfer of intake of internal affairs complaints in Oakland from the Internal Affairs Division to the CPRB, the Citizens Police Review Board, which is a civilian agency that is supposed to be the independent watchdog of the Oakland Police Department. The council approved funds for this. They approved $1.4 million in 2011 for the 2011-2013 budget to complete this transfer, but it's yet to happen, and we're well past the time period in which that was supposed to happen. So Santana's been accused of diverting about half this money to a new office of the Inspector General. The current OIG exists within OPD, within the police department, and it's independent of the city administrator. Her proposal is to transfer it under her control and then use that money to hire two policy analysts. So essentially, it's basically a power grab, because the Office of the Inspector General has been putting out a number of reports in the past year or so that have been, you know, very refreshing for their honesty and their candor about how the police department can do better in some situations. So they're doing their job, but now there's a situation where the Office of the Inspector General is being used as a political football by the city administrator, and they're taking money away from a budget item that the council voted on they're taking half that money to a initiative that the council didn't vote on. It's actually the city administrator's own project that the mayor signed off on because, you know, she wanted to sign off on it. But the council is not pleased with this at all. So that's expected to come up in the next few weeks, and there may even be some public actions on this next week.
And the vote on the latest allocation of $2 million to expand the Domain Awareness Center in Oakland will go to the Oakland City Council on July 30th. Ollie Winston, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ollie Winston is a freelance writer who's been covering police and civil liberties issues, particularly in the city of Oakland, for the East Bay Express and the Center for Investigative Reporting. among many other outlets. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert.
And coming up on 7:30 in the morning, here's what we've got coming up. The implementation of Obamacare. What does it mean for you? Statistics just hit the press earlier this week that in the state of New York, healthcare premiums are expected to drop an average of 50% next year. We're going to find out why and what that means for other states like California, and take a look at the stakes in the newest fights on the floor of Congress over the implementation of that law. So stay tuned for that after this news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with news headlines. University of California Regents voted to confirm Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano as the first woman to lead the UC system as president. The student regent, Cynthia Flores, was the only regent to vote against Napolitano, citing the record number of deportations she has presided over as head of Homeland Security. Napolitano is set to start her job in late September. Detroit has become the largest city in the country ever to file for Chapter 9 bankruptcy. The Republican Governor Rick Snyder called bankruptcy the one feasible path for the city, which has long-term debt that could be as high as $20 billion. Trayvon Martin's parents are speaking out for the first time since a jury acquitted George Zimmerman on all charges in the shooting death of their teenage son. Sabrina Fulton said the verdict came as a complete shock to her. Tracy Martin said he thought juror B-37, who had an interview on CNN, had her mind made up from the start of the trial.
What if it was their child that was murdered, that was shot in the heart? Would they feel as though it was their child's blame for their death? I think that was a very insensitive statement coming from her. But then again, we see that she likes separating herself by saying they. So from the beginning of the trial, she had her mind made up.
Texas Governor Rick Perry signed sweeping new abortion restrictions into law that could force the closure of most of the state's clinics that provide the procedure.
It is our responsibility and duty to give voice to the unborn, the individuals whose survival is at stake. This bill lives up to that responsibility.
Protesters outside the chamber chanted shame. Opponents have vowed to fight the law, though no court challenges were immediately filed. The law restricts abortions to surgical centers and requires doctors who work at clinics providing abortions to have hospital admitting privileges. The law also bans abortions after the 20th week of pregnancy and dictates when abortion-inducing drugs can be taken. The wave of Ramadan violence in Iraq claimed more victims today. At least 17 people were killed when a bomb exploded inside a Sunni mosque in central Iraq during midday prayers. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, patchy morning fog and clouds, then sunny. Highs in the 70s to lower 80s around the bay, then 90s in the warmest interior valleys. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny. Highs 97 to 103 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandary. I'll have more news at 8 o'clock.
I'm Sonali Kohatkar, and you're listening to Upfront on KPFA. House Republicans put up their 38th and 39th efforts at blocking the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature health care reform law. Two votes in the House to delay both the employer mandate and the individual mandate on health care passed with overwhelming Republican support and came soon after Obama announced a one-year delay in the implementation of the employer mandate aspect of the law. The votes, which are being seen as largely symbolic, come at the same time that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that individual premium rates will fall by at least 50% when that state's insurance exchange is implemented next year. The so-called exchanges are a significant part of the law, and New York joins California in being among the earliest states to begin implementing the Affordable Care Act. My guest is Paul Song. He is a radiation oncologist and a member of the faculty at the Samuel Ostin Cancer Center at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. He's also a visiting fellow with the California Department of Insurance on Healthcare Policy and on the Board of Physicians for National Health Program, the Courage Campaign, and People for the American Way. Welcome to Upfront, Paul Song.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first of all, the House's attempts to delay this law are seen as largely symbolic, I mentioned. 39 times now that the House has tried to block this law?
It's really crazy. You would think that even if they were to continue to pass it, that the Senate will never let it get through, and then the president would never sign it. So the amount of time and energy that's been wasted trying to repeal this is really ridiculous.
Now, wouldn't they, you would imagine, celebrate the fact that New Yorkers will now get cheaper premiums, at least those who are needing to buy individual insurance premiums, that they would get cheaper premiums through these exchanges, as the governor just announced?
Well, I think when you really look at the heart of this whole Affordable Care Act, it really was a Republican idea from the very, very beginning. And had it been really proposed by anyone other than President Obama, I think they would be cheering it. But you have to look at sort of the impetus to why they've been so against this for so long. There's nothing in this that's socialized, if anything. Some of us on the left think this is nothing but a corporate giveaway to the private insurance industry. Having said that, what you're seeing in states like New York, and to some degree in California, is rates are much lower than the doomsayers said they would be. One thing we need to realize, though, is the individual mandate, which has become this huge crux of such disdain, is such a small percentage of our whole population. When you look at the way the Affordable Care Act was originally designed, out of the 51 million Americans who were uninsured, 32 million were going to be covered by the Affordable Care Act. Roughly 16 million were going to be covered by Medicaid expansion, and 16 million were going to be covered by the individual mandate. So that's less than 5% of our entire country, and yet this is the area that everyone's so angry about. The majority of Americans are angry not because it personally affects them, but because they're told this is something you should be outraged by. But in reality, it really won't hurt or help them in any way. It's those people who are trying to find insurance on their own who will actually see their costs come down in some respect.
So let's talk about these exchanges and the fact that they are only now starting, with states are scrambling to try to put them together. Mm-hmm. In California, there's a huge effort, as there is in New York, to train hundreds, thousands of people who will be helping to put these together. But they sound complicated. Essentially, it's some sort of online marketplace where insurance companies can offer individual plans for people.
It's really like an Expedia or an Orbitz. Instead of trying to find a hotel or a plane flight, you're trying to find a health insurance plan. There are three main types of health insurance plans that are going to be on these exchanges, and they all have either a gold, silver, or bronze designation, and that's really designed to represent the percent coverage that you'll get. Either 70, 80, or 90% of all your medical bills will be covered by this exchange. The problem is that while this is a good thing in that people have coverage, the number of medical-related bankruptcies, because not everything will be covered, will continue to climb. And that's the thing that I think people on the left need to realize. This is not a magic elixir in any way, but there's a lot of good things in this bill.
And so when you look at this bill, and you're on the board of Physicians for a National Health Program, the mm-hmm. huge movement around the country for a single-payer program, and many of those folks have really criticized the Affordable Care Act. But given that this is what we have now, what would you point out as being the highlights of this particular act? I'm assuming the insurance exchanges among them?
Yes, and well, first and foremost, the things that have been implemented already that we all know about, so kids under the age of 26 being able to stay on their parents' plans, no denial of pre-existing conditions, no rescissions, a lot of preventative care being covered. Those are things that many of us will see now when we go to the doctor or try to seek care. Those are the positive things. With regard to the exchange, California has been very aggressive in setting this up, much more so than a lot of the other states. And it's good because there are, again, a lot of options for people who otherwise would not have had options before. What's happened in New York with the exchange, and the reason the costs have come down, it's a little misleading in the sense that they always had an exchange, and they always allowed people to not be denied for pre-existing conditions, but there was no individual mandate. So the idea is the pooling of everyone, because of the government mandate, those people that didn't have insurance who now are required to buy it will spread out the risk. And in doing so, that's ultimately what's bringing the cost down. Also in California, New York, I just want to say one other thing. 2 years ago, they voted to allow the insurance commissioner to have the ability to regulate insurance rates, which we don't have in California. Mm-hmm. So in those states, there's 37 states now where the insurance commissioner can regulate the insurance rates. You don't have the price gouging that you have, such as in the state of California.
Right. So I understand that the law would essentially require that something like 80% of your premium costs have to actually go towards covering health care, you know, health care costs. And if that doesn't happen, that the buyers of these plans Americans will get rebates?
Correct. And again, that is also something that is a positive step, but it needs two parts. So the federal bill, currently the private insurance industry takes about 31 cents of every dollar away from actual health care. That's used for exorbitant salaries, overhead, marketing, administrative costs. What the Affordable Care Act has said is for individual plans, they now need to spend 20 cents of every, they can only take 20 cents of every dollar away. So 80 cents has to be spent on actual patient care. That's what they call the medical loss. And it's pretty sad that you have to term it a loss, that the insurance industry views that as a loss, whereas we view that as something positive to benefit our patients. With a small business and large plans, it has to be 85 cents of every dollar actually has to be spent on actual patient care. The problem is the federal law does not require regulation of rates. It doesn't set that authority. So let's say I'm an insurance plan and I need to make a certain amount of money each year, but I can only spend 80 cents of every dollar on, I can only take 20 cents of every dollar. Well, what do? I just increase the overall premium. So without
having... just make sure that even the 80% that you're spending, that you end up just increasing the cost of health care.
Correct. So without having that second component, which the insurance lobby fought very vigorously to prevent from being placed into the Affordable Care Act, that a lot of critics argue that healthcare costs are going to continue to rise, that you're not going to bring it down. And in New York, the good news is, yes, for the individual market, the rates came down 50%. The problem is the individual mandate penalty is so measly. First, we know there's no enforcement mechanism, and we also know that the maximum is about $695 that the average person will be fined if they don't do the individual mandates. So the concern is, while this is great, rates came down 50%, then 1 or 2 years, if all these people refuse to sign up for it because they can just pay the $695 penalty, then rates are going to go back up again because you're not pooling the risk at that point.
And the $695, if you were to take that penalty and put it towards a premium, it may still not get you good enough coverage. So people might feel it's worth it just to pay the fine and hedge their bets so they won't fall sick.
That's true. And again, most people are going to try to buy the cheapest thing that they're asked to buy, which is the bronze plan.
Particularly young folks, folks that are less likely to get sick in the first place.
Correct.
Whose insurance plans are needed to even out the costs of older folks or people who fall sick more often. Right?
And I know somebody who's young in his 20s who has insurance, who was very active and was climbing and he broke his leg, needed surgery. It was a major compound fracture. And by the time you took away the deductibles, and if the insurance plan, let's say the best plan, is only covering 80% of your total costs, he was still $20,000 in the hole. And the average person is going to go bankrupt from that.
Right.
That's my concern, that last year in the United States there were 4 million bankruptcies, and two-thirds of those were due to medical illness. And what's scary is in those two-thirds of the people that went bankrupt because of a medical illness, 66% of those people actually had insurance.
Wow.
So if we have an insured population that's going bankrupt because of medical illness, and yet we're still leaving these big gaps, that's a big problem that I see.
Now, the employer mandate also has a fine, right? And even that's not that big. I understand something like $2,000 per person.
Correct.
So if a company decides that it's actually not worth it, that it might be easier for them or cheaper for them to pay the $2,000 fine rather than insure their employees? Do you conceive of that happening?
Absolutely. And then you also see companies like Walmart that don't pay a fine altogether, that they reduce the hours to less.
How is that? How did they know?
So two ways that they do that. One is, and this is why there's been a delay in terms of the mandate on small businesses and corporations. But the big thing is companies like Walmart, what they'll do is they will give people low enough rates so then technically they qualify for Medicaid. So they can't go out and buy insurance on their own, but because you've paid them but sufficiently, so low enough that they don't qualify for any major benefits, it's all on the states to supply health insurance to these people because they're in the poverty level.
Paul, let's talk about politics. President Obama, in announcing a one-year delay of the employer mandate aspect of the law, many say that concession emboldened the Republicans to take the votes that they took yesterday. I mean, does anybody on Capitol Hill actually want to see this law implemented? Problematic as it is, but some people have put their weight behind it, and yet it just keeps getting delayed and delayed.
It's a very, very good question. And rather than looking at the Republicans trying to tear this down, I would try to see where are the Democrats speaking with one voice and showing of support. I think the concern I have with the upcoming midterm elections is just like in 2010, which many people argue was the impetus to have the whole change of power in the House, is that you will have a lot of Democrats who stood behind this very vulnerable. What I think the people need to realize is, all in all, this is a very positive bill. It's not exactly what I would have liked. I would have liked to have seen, as you mentioned, a single-payer system, but there are a lot of positive things that we should really stress. And for the majority of Americans, this is really not going to affect them at all. It's going to actually make their health care better.
Well, finally, speaking of single-payer, the closest model that we have to a single-payer system is Medicare, and this month marks the 48th anniversary of Medicare. How could Medicare change with the implementation of this act, and is it still a system that provides a good model for what we could see expanded to the entire population?
So it's interesting. I'm actually 2 weeks older than Medicare, I look at the birthday of Medicare. It's July 30th, and it was in 1965, so I was actually born 2 weeks before that. It's something I've studied very extensively. I think Medicare has so many positives. As we know, before this, 50% of all seniors were uninsured before the start of Medicare. The concern with Medicare, everyone says, is it's not sustainable. I argue part of the reason it's not sustainable is because the government has never been serious about protecting Medicare. Medicare Part D, which was a big gift to the pharmaceutical industry, has prevented Medicare from negotiating pharmaceutical rates.
Right.
If you look at Medicare Advantage plans, which was the big part of these Medicare HMOs, which was part of the Affordable Care Act, that they found we were overpaying over $700 billion over the last 20 years to the private insurance industry to take care of seniors. That was supposed to be removed, and that money was supposed to be awarded to preserve Medicare. But instead, Kathleen Sebelius has increased the payments to private insurers this last year. The only way Medicare is going to be sustainable is to increase the eligibility. So allow younger people like us, instead of buying a for-profit product that doesn't care about us and our health and only makes money by denying us care, let us buy into Medicare. By us paying into Medicare, we're low risk. We will add a cash infusion into Medicare and also allow more seniors to benefit from the effects.
And this could be an option, right? This wouldn't even have to be a requirement. It would be interesting if the government did simply allow people to opt into Medicare if they chose. If they liked their current plan, they could keep it.
Absolutely, because if you look at seniors, and having had my parents on Medicare, their patient satisfaction is much greater with Medicare than it was with the private insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone says that the government comes between you and your health care, but Medicare is one example where it doesn't. As a practicing physician, Medicare never tells me what tests I can order. It doesn't tell my parents what doctor they can go see or what hospital they can go to, but the private insurance industry tells us that all the time.
All the time, right. And very briefly, you mentioned earlier about the pre-existing conditions now essentially being banned by this Affordable Care Act. Explain that. Is that an open and shut case, or are there exceptions? I mean, I think a lot of people can't believe that this could actually be true, that they could, from now on, not have any earlier conditions being used as a reason for an insurance company to either not cover them or to provide them with worse coverage.
I get asked this all the time because as an oncologist, I treat people with cancer, and they're worried about leaving their job and trying to get a new job and the problem of getting health care coverage. What we know, though, is that that can no longer be denied. They can't look at any aspect of that. But there is a but to that. Insurance companies can still charge you more than they charge me. Before, they wouldn't insure you at all. If they found out you had, you know, cancer, they're not going to touch you with a 10-foot pole. But they'll touch you now, but they'll just make your premium substantially higher. It won't be as high as it would have been before. At least they have to cover you, because the idea is that younger people will come in and they'll spread out the risk again. But that is still something we have to work on.
So that's the loophole.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Paul, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Paul Song is a radiation oncologist and a visiting fellow with the California Department of Insurance and Healthcare Policy. He's on the board of a number of organizations, including Physicians for a National Health Program.
Drilling, spilling, closer to death with every gallon you're filling. Drilling, spilling, you're gonna throw it all away. Oil is where the money goes. It's why spread. When troubles rear their head, it's the common thread. It poisons your rivers and makes your streets blow red. Why not run your engines on blood instead?
That is a new song from the San Francisco Mine Troupe.
throw it all away. Part of their brand new production, Oil and Water, which is coming soon to a park near you. The Mime Troupe is now in its 54th year of bringing political theater to public spaces for free. And this year they have actually rolled out two plays in one. Joining me to talk about them is longtime Mime Trooper Valina Brown. Welcome and thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Crude Intentions and Deal with the Devil. What are they about?
Well, they are about oil and water. Deal with the Devil is set in the Oval Office. And it's in a future, a sort of a dystopic future, film noir-esque sort of thing where our environment has been very degraded and the District of Columbia is in a climate control bubble. So that's sort of like the upstairs story. The Madam President appears to have been murdered. She apparently was drowned in oil. She was the environmentalist president, and it looks like she was going to sell out and sell the last thing that the United States had, which was its water, to oil companies. It looks like she's been murdered, and the vice president is now faced with, well, is he going to move forward with the deal that she was poised to make, you know, regarding the water, or is he going to do something else? So he's getting a lot of pressure to just go with the flow and business as usual, and doesn't really get any support to maybe do anything different until the devil shows up. So that's Deal with the Devil. And I play the devil. And then Crude Intentions is set more in the life in the world of the everyday person who has to work for a living. So Tomasa and Gracie, they are a couple, two women who are working in together in a restaurant. And Tomasa has a past in that she was an environmentalist and she was in the Amazon filming what was going on with Chevron and poisoning the Amazon, and they really leaned on her. They forced her to give all of her raw footage, but she kept this rough cut, and that has come to light because of a single email she sent to a professor about it, and they found out, Chevron found out about it because of this email spying that's happening. So that's sort of what they're, you know, about. Like, we have these environmental challenges. We have 15 years to get it together as a species, and the United States being one of the bigger consumers of fossil fuels and emitters of you know, carbon and stuff. So we don't have a lot of time to get it together. So from the standpoint of the president, the new president at one point says, what can I do? I'm only the president. And then people who are not as powerful in the powerful position as a president are often going, what can I do? What can I do about this? It's like these corporations and people with money, the Koch brothers, David Koch makes an appearance, a big appearance in Crude Intentions.
He's had to make more appearances since Dick Cheney left the stage, I've noticed in your
productions. Well, yeah, played by different actors. But
It's a little bit different doing political satire in the age of Obama, isn't it?
Say a little more about what you mean by that.
Uh-oh, now you're asking the questions.
Well, let me know what you mean.
Now you've got plays happening in a dystopic future, and it seemed like every year, practically, for the Bush years, the Mime Troupe production had a Cheney figure on stage.
Mm-hmm.
More often than it had a Bush figure on stage, but mm-hmm. that it was easier to root the plots of the plays in the present and in the concrete.
Well, there's a couple of things. For one, Ed Helms, for a time, looked almost exactly like Dick Cheney.
Through no fault of his own.
Yes. So we may as well work with that, you know? With Obama, I mean, I guess similar to when Clinton was in office, it's not that every little thing either one of them does is magic, but it isn't like what we would be doing if Romney had won.
Mm-hmm.
But we're definitely saying, look, these are the things that, you know, we're expecting of you. And these are some things that you promised. And, you know, we're still expecting that.
Speaking with Valina Brown, she's a longtime member of the San Francisco Mime Troupe, which has just opened its 54th season with a double feature called Oil and Water. And you can find showtimes at sfmt.org. Tell us a little bit about the material side of your production. How do you manage to put on free shows in parks all summer long and still pay the rent at the beginning of the month?
There are different pieces of the pie, of the financial pie. So we have, you know, foundations that give us grants. And then we did have for 27 years, like the NEA and some other anchor funders. And then we have appeals.
I think we just buried the lead. You lost your funding from the National Endowment for the Arts?
Yes, we did, for the first time in 27 years.
How big a hit is that?
We almost weren't able to do the show this year. And we're feeling very passionate about this topic. And it was really, and so we launched an emergency campaign called The Cost of Free in April. So we are very, very appreciative. If we have any listeners who are a part of that, we want to thank you so much. For there was a small group of people who really did come forward and say, well, this just can't be. You must. So we were able to raise enough money to move forward, but in a cut down form.
Will it be enough to keep you going if you can't get the NEA back on board?
What we got in the Cost of Free campaign?
Mm-hmm.
No. What we've gotten is enough to do this season in this form. And so our task from henceforth is to figure out how we're going to do it next year and the next and the next. I think the thing that's interesting, though, for me, just when I pull back philosophically and think about this sort of thing, because we're not the only ones that are dealing with difficult times and reduced funding and changing budgets. And I think that it's the challenge for, I guess, all of us to figure out a way not to just try to hold on to the past or the status quo or an old definition of normal, but to really retool in a way that is more about adaptability. For the foreseeable future, it's going to be about how to adapt to continually rolling changes and shocks that I think are just going to be kind of our new normal for a while.
Well, it's a sad note to close on, but it is a wonderful show to attend. Belinda Brown, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Belinda Brown's a member of the San Francisco Mime Troupe. They've just opened their 54th season with a double feature called Oil and Water. Two plays for the price of none. You can find show times at SFMT, that's short for San Francisco Mime Troupe, .org. And wanted to let you know about a couple other things. Coming up this weekend, the Vukani Mwetu Choir and many, many other groups are putting on a celebration of the life, legacy, and values of Nelson Mandela, marking the occasion of his 95th birthday. The East Bay celebration is this Sunday, July 21st, 3 p.m. at Berkeley's Black Repertory Theater, and the event is free and open to the public. Also coming up on the KPFA events calendars, we are hosting a talk by the Reverend Byron Williams. That's Thursday, July 25th at the Black Repertory Theater, hosted by Gabrielle Wilsons. The following week, we're also bringing to the stage Alice Walker. That is Wednesday, the 31st, at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley. You can get details on both of those events on our website, kpfa.org/events. You can get tickets at brownpapertickets.com or local independent booksellers. And that does it for today's show. Upfront is a production of the KPFA News Department that airs weekday mornings at 7 a.m. We'd like to hear what you think of the show, so if you ever want to yell at us about something we said or suggest something for us to cover, send an email to upfront@kpfa.org or get on Facebook and look for Upfront there. Our theme music is Turn It Up by the Digital Primitives. Eileen Alfender is our executive producer and news editor. Laura Privis is our senior producer, assistant producer Bipasha Shom. Rod Akil is on the soundboard today. My co-host from KPFK in Los Angeles is Sonali Kolhatkar. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert, and when I see you next, we will be in Fun Drive. If you have any time free, please come in and volunteer in our phone room. It opens at 6:30 in the morning. The address is 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley. That starts Monday morning at 7 a.m. The Morning Mix is next.
KPFA's Summer Fun Drive begins Monday, July 22nd through Friday, August 2nd.
Help support listener-sponsored radio with your generous financial contribution. And if you have free time, please come on down to the station and help us in the phone room. You'll meet on-air personalities, like-minded listeners, and we'll provide you with carbohydrates, strong coffee, and some unexpected surprises. KPFA is located at 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, near the corner of University Avenue in Berkeley. The phone room opens 6:30 a.m. Monday through Friday and 7 a.m. Saturday and Sunday. You can donate securely online at www.kpfa.org.